I'd like to talk this morning some more about a topic that I have been talking about the last week or so, topic which for some people has been unpopular, so I'll continue to be unpopular, the topic of renunciation. And what I thought I'd do is approach it in a different way than I have before, a little bit different, and that is to offer you the simplest one of the simplest and most pleasant meditation instructions that I know. And start that, let that be the start of the talk. So the instructions are, set yourself at ease. So sit down to meditate. Set yourself at ease, some mental ease, physical ease, emotional ease. Set yourself with some ease. And that can be, doesn't have to be dramatic, just can be at ease with your uneasiness. It can just be some little bit more ease than what you have. Set yourself at ease. And then notice whatever happens that takes you away from that. That's it. Isn't that great? So set yourself at ease and then notice whatever it is that takes you away from that. And the idea being, if you notice really carefully what takes you away from that, is that somehow you'll find your ease again in a variety of ways. One is maybe you realize that what takes you away from your ease is not worth it. It's not worth giving up or losing your ease for the kind of concerns, preoccupation, worries that that grabs the mind, or the thoughts that grab the mind. And so maybe you're just willing to let go of it and come back to your easeful place. You might also notice that notice as you pay attention to what takes you away from your ease, that if you're lucky, that the attention that notices that is easeful itself. Sometimes it happens. That the very act of noticing is itself a beautiful, peaceful quality of the mind. And part of what we do in mindfulness practice is practice long enough, sometimes it takes a while, to learn this aspect of attention or awareness, that awareness in and of itself does not judge or criticize what it is knowing, but awareness itself, it has a quality of peacefulness, at ease. Awareness by itself has a lot of wonderful qualities if you start paying attention to it. Another quality is that awareness by itself has no self-reference. So all our self-referencing tendencies, how it's good for me, or how I'm being threatened here, or myself, my sense of self, my self-identity, has no role in awareness by itself. So set yourself at ease and notice what takes you away from it. Can open up to a great study, a great discovery of different aspects of who we are. As we set ourselves at ease and do this practice, then what we'll tend to discover is that there's deeper and deeper levels of ease. So at first it might be just a modicum of ease, just a little bit, you know, 1% more easeful than you are when you sat down. But as you do the practice, and you begin pushing the edge of that ease and learning how to be more easeful, more peaceful, more calm with what's going on. And as you discover and kind of push that edge, it becomes a wonderful discovery process about what it is that takes us away from our ease. Ease away from the ease. Peace, conflict, peace, anxiety, peace, daydreaming, peace, ambition, desire, all kinds of stuff that takes us away. And really understanding and getting familiar with this world of what takes us away from ease, from a sense of well-being, is a really important part of the meditation practice. So rather than thinking that you're supposed to push that away, you're supposed to get to know it. Notice what that is. Become familiar with it. Noticing isn't just something you notice in a flash, but you notice it, but then you want to study it. You want to become familiar with it. Oh, this is what it's like to lose my ease. This is what's going on for me. This is the kind of thoughts I have, the kind of feelings I have. And as you get to know something really well, then it becomes easier to find your ease again, find your balance in the midst of what's going on. So this whole process then is a negotiation between where your ease is and where your unease is. And there's a lot of things we discover in the process of that. We discover our deep, cherished beliefs about what we think is really important, what we really need as a human being. I need to have, you know, whatever. You know, I need to have X, Y, and Z. But you find out that actually maybe you don't need it. Our simple state, there's a state of simplicity, a state of ease, a state of peace, that requires almost nothing. It doesn't require a sense of self to prop ourselves up. It doesn't require entertainment. It doesn't require recreational opportunities. It doesn't require a bank account. It doesn't require a nice house. It doesn't require... So a lot of things it doesn't require. The heart or the mind has a capacity of tremendous peace and ease without being propped up or supported by many things that people chase in the world that we live in. We often have the idea that we need a lot of things in order to be happy. And so people are chasing a lot of different things. And in our society here, there's a lot of consumer messages, a lot of social messages about what people think they need to have in order to be happy. And generally, they don't make people happy. It might bring some pleasure, it might bring some status, it might bring some all kinds of certain qualities of things that are sometimes desirable and useful. But it can hide the fact that the heart in and of itself can be have a very deep sense of peace without being propped up and supported by anything at all around us. You don't have to be in a relationship. You don't have to be out of a relationship. You don't have to have good health. You don't have to have poor health. You don't have to have, you know, there's a lot of things we don't need to have in order to find some kind of basic deep ease or peace in the heart. And then as we kind of exploring that edge of ease, we'll notice all the different beliefs that tell us it should be different. It has to be different. If only I had this, then I could relax. If only this, if only that. Things that take us away. One of the things we discover is how much the things that take us away from our ease also takes us away from the present moment. When you sit down to meditate, you'll find that the easy place as you go deeper is the present moment, is here. Something's already here. Just being present in some way. And that the forces of dis-ease, unease, tend to take us away from that. So we get lost in our thoughts, thinking about the future, planning and planning, or remembering the past, or reviewing conversations, repeating conversation, or fantasizing about desires or forces of ill will or angry about, or just fantasizing. And it takes us away from the present moment. And so there becomes a negotiation also of why am I leaving the present moment? What's so interesting about what's not here? Why is it more interesting for my mind to be preoccupied and thinking about something else rather than to be fully, completely here for this experience right now? And so it's a process of discovery. What is that? And I think the intelligent approach to meditation is to not just think it's a not approach it as a pursuit of calm or peace in and of itself, but it's a pursuit of calm and peace through self-understanding, through understanding what makes us tick, in particular, what makes us want to leave the present moment. What is it that wants us, for what are we willing to give up our sense of peace and well-being? I'm becoming a little bit aware that there's a small movement. There's good reason why I know people aren't learning about it very quickly. One aspect of it is a slow food movement. You heard about the slow food movement? And so people are finding value in preparing their food carefully, I guess, and eating it slowly, and not just rushing, grabbing a bite to eat, and kind of continuing with your very important life. That something very important is to be found in slowing down and being fully present for the experience that we're having. And so then there's a slow movement, that maybe it's better to live life a little bit slower than always being in the fast track. You know about the rat race, right? And the thing about the rat race is that even if you win, you're still a rat. So to slow down, to live a life slower, for a lot of the qualities that benefit that come from that, the peace, the well-being, the sense of greater connectedness with other people, our family, our community, our neighbors, the possibilities of love and compassion that are there. Some of the best qualities, best experiences human beings can have as human beings come when we're fully present. And when we're not fully present, some of the highest qualities of beingness is not available to us. So a list of things like joy and love and friendship and peace come from being in the present moment. And we increase the possibility of them being part of our lives when we are present. But if we're rushing around doing 10,000 things, it's not so likely to happen. And so there's also a movement afoot, various forms. It pops up periodically in different books in different ways, of people wanting to simplify their lives. And people argue that there's a lot of benefit in simplifying lives. Wonderful qualities of being arise. Someone told me yesterday that he discovered that how much happier he was when he had simplified his life quite radically. And he didn't have, didn't have high quality clothes and old kind of hand-me-downs. But he lived his life quite happily now. He wasn't kind of chasing after all the things that he felt he needed to have before. So to start living a life of simplicity, not because it's a moral thing to do, that we're Puritans, but rather because there's tremendous richness to be discovered in living more simply. And a life that's too complicated, we lose something. Now, one of the things we lose, for some people, is what can be called the spiritual side of our life. That side of our life, that side of the heart, which is capable of peace, of love, of compassion, of joy, kind of spiritual joy. And my sense is that that part of the heart is very shy. And there are other voices in the psyche that can very easily dominate and be very loud. And so part of the art of learning a spiritual life is learning to tune into a voice which initially is very, very shy. And it needs a lot of space and kindness and simplicity to begin kind of showing itself. And I think it's one of the reasons why a lot of spiritual tradition has something equivalent to a Sabbath, where you're not supposed to do much. Some traditions, you're not even supposed to drive a car or turn on light switches, or just kind of radical simplicity for the day. You're not supposed to work. The stores are supposed to be closed. In the Buddhist tradition, there's similar things. There's kind of a observance day where people go to the monastery or live very simple lives for the day. Yesterday we had one. We had a day-long retreat here, which is kind of like a Sabbath day. People come here and they live very simply for the hours they're here. All the main things going on is people meditate and they have lunch and they meditate some more. You don't get much more simpler than that. So something happens in that simplicity that if you give yourself long enough time, that's quite pristine, quite beautiful. If you go and do it on a retreat, like you do it over a number of days, it's really exquisite what can happen at times. The sense of peace, sense of well-being, sense of connectedness to the world around us. Someone can see a candy wrapper on the ground and see how beautiful it is. it's just, wow, it just sparkles. Because when the mind is really quiet and still and peaceful, what we see around us is much more beautiful. We just kind of pick up on the wonderfulness of life. So to set the mind at ease and then notice what takes us away from it. So what does this have to do with renunciation? The word renunciation is an English word and might not be a good translation of the Buddhist word that's translated as renunciation. The Buddhist word, but before I tell you the Buddhist word, I want to tell you a different a kind of English word, which kind of has almost the same meaning, a similar meaning at least, the word sacrifice. Also not a very popular word. Often it's kind of, the associations with sacrifice is you're being diminished by it. You have to sacrifice something and it's like, it doesn't always have good connotations. But the word sacrifice in Latin means to make sacred. That's what it means, to make sacred. And so the word renunciation then, there's something about the act of renunciation, the act of sacrificing that can connect a person to what is sacred or to what is precious or something that's really wonderful. So now I'll tell you the Pali word. It's nikamma. And ne, the prefix, means out. And the word kamma here comes from the verbal root to walk or to go. And so nikamma means to go out or to come out. And so it doesn't exactly fit with renunciation. Renunciation means re-announce in Latin root. What does that mean? To come out. And the Pali's connotation is not, this focus is not on what's being left behind, but rather where you're going. Coming out of a confined situation, a contracted situation, some situation where the heart or the mind is contracted or confined, and you're coming out of that into a situation where that's like open space, expansive, peaceful. And that's the connotation of the word nikamma, coming out into an expansive open space, open air. So the focus a little bit more is this association of the word nikamma is a little more what is gained in this act of renunciation. Whereas the English word for many people, I think association is it's just kind of a depressing word. Depending on the religious background you have, it's kind of it's self-denigrating, diminishes. We have more diminishing ourselves or denying ourselves. Self-denial is associated with the word renunciation, in a way that's kind of painful and difficult. But the focus in the Buddhist idea of renunciation is on what is gained, rather than what is lost. And so then we have to understand what is possible to gain. And so this idea of set yourself at ease points to a capacity and possibility of peace, of deep well-being that can exist in our heart. And what does it take to gain that possibility? How do we find that? And what are we willing to sacrifice or give up so that we can have this higher quality of aliveness, a higher quality of being? So the focus is on what is gained and not lost. But still, it might require some letting go or surrendering or sacrificing something. Now, there's all kinds of things that people are willing to sacrifice. Like some of you probably be quite willing to sacrifice quite a bit of your fear or your anxiety. Well, that's easy. I'll renounce that. Thank you. Or you're willing to sacrifice, there's all kinds of, going to McDonald's. Someone told me today about the movie. What was it called? It was called Supersizing. Just hearing about the movie, I was ready to sacrifice, renounce McDonald's forever. And so there's a lot of things people are kind of willing to renounce easily, perhaps. And then there's things we kind of know that are not healthy for us, we're sometimes finding it difficult to renounce because we're lazy or because it brings us kind of pleasure or do something. And we know it's not really good for us in the big picture, but then maybe in the immediate moment, it kind of satisfies a certain kind of loneliness or a certain kind of desire for comfort or to something. And so we kind of give into it. We say, oh, I wish I hadn't. It would have been better if I didn't. And maybe I'm a kind of unusual person, but I find that I almost never watch television. But I notice that when I do watch television, I tend to feel kind of, it's kind of nice, a little bit in the moment sometimes. But at the end of watching what I was watching, I kind of feel kind of drained. I don't feel good. I say, what was that? I wish I hadn't. So I might be unusual because I have a very poor diet of television. So maybe I haven't built up my resistance or my strength. I haven't gotten, I don't have a certain kind of strength that maybe a lot of people have, from the capacity to watch television. And then they're sacrificing. So in part of that, kind of renouncing some of the things is giving up, impulses within ourselves. And there's a lot of impulses which are not that we can have, which are not to our own benefit, our own well-being. So, what are they? What are some of the impulses that some of you have that you're willing to admit in public that you think is not so beneficial for yourself? It's not really to your highest interest that you'd willing to. Anybody want to offer some impulses? I'm getting a list here. It doesn't have to be your own, actually. What do you do, someone next to you? someone that you know about. If I do it that way, it's a little bit safer. Yes?
Buy something when I don't need it.
Buy something when you don't need it.
I have a huge love of caffeine.
So, a huge love of caffeine. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Reading email several times a day.
Reading email several times a day. Feeling you have to kind of be on top of it. Yes?
Overeating.
The impulse to be correct.
The impulse to be correct. So listening to the news, NPR. What else?
Working all the time.
Working all the time. Well, you see, it's really good to work all the time, because if you work all the time, you don't have to look at yourself. And that's painful for some people. That's part of the reason why some people work all the time. Is they, I mean, I'm not saying, you know, but they it's like, you know, then you don't have to deal with what's really going on. Sorry?
You're busy all the time.
Busy all the time, yeah.
Worry all the time.
Worry. All the time worrying. Worrying.
Noise, just music or chatter.
Just noise, music, chattering. Just keeping it always going. Mm-hmm. It'll be kind of addictive after a while. It's kind of like hard to give it up.
Impulse to criticize other drivers.
Impulse to criticize other drivers.
Impulse to accomplish all the time.
Impulse to accomplish all the time. Mm-hmm.
Impulse to protect myself from hurt.
From
hurt? From harm.
From harm. So that's something that would be useful to renounce, you think? Sometimes it would be nice.
It's a little.
So sometimes protecting oneself is creating too much of a shell. It's not really needed. The paradox is sometimes if we protect ourselves too much, we cause more harm to ourselves than what we think the world's going to do to us.
To forget.
The impulse to forget as an act. Something you choose to do?
It seems as if I have trouble assimilating the material. I have to relearn the lesson.
Well, if it's just your human capacity, you don't have. Then I don't see you have any choice but to do it if you need to learn. I mean, if you have that, you know. But some people will choose to ignore. Some, you know, Freud called it denial. Sometimes if you choose to not take something in. And so they have to learn over and over again. And that we have some choice. Then it's an impulse that we can renounce.
Yes. And it can also resemble the experience of feeling such conclusive self-disgust that I'll never forget this lesson again. And yet finding myself.
Needing to learn it again.
Repeating the behavior.
Yes, please.
Impulsive expectation.
Impulsive expectation. That's dangerous.
Seeking the company of others?
Seeking the company of others. So that's something you're ready... There's some aspect of that which you feel is good to renounce?
Yeah, I think it's sort of often just, you know, just like turning on the television or reading the news, just another way of seeking distraction from being with what's going on.
So sometimes seeking company of others is another form of distraction from really being present for what's going on. Impulse to solve other people's problems.
Impulse for judgment.
Impulse what?
For judgment.
Impulse for judgment. Yes.
To drive fast.
Impulse to drive fast. You ready to give that up? Not you. Someone else. Other people. Other people. I'm sorry. I forgot about. Yes?
Something I've been struggling with for a long time is being in service for others, but doing it for function or for acknowledgement instead of coming from a solid base.
So having the wrong impulses for doing service. It's maybe more selfish or more about yourself or about fear or all kinds of things. Could be reasons for what looks like a really wonderful thing to do, but the motivations are a little bit off.
The impulse to fill the silence with words.
The impulse to fill the silence with words.
Ooh, I agree.
Yes. The impulse to find fault. In particular with political situations. The impulse to find fault. To criticize at a moment's notice. Some people are good at that.
The impulse to be the best.
The impulse to be the best.
Regret.
Renounce regret.
Control.
Impulse to control. Need to control. It can be renounced sometimes, and other people will be very grateful. Yes?
The impulse to resist change.
The impulse to resist change. The need to be perfect.
The impulse to look at what's missing, what I don't have.
The impulse to look at what's missing, what I don't have.
The impulse to put off.
The impulse to put off.
Put off for tomorrow.
So in letting go of that, you have to start work. If you don't let go of it, then you can be lazy. Do nothing.
The impulse to play Free Cell.
The impulse to play Free Cell. On the computer? On the computer.
I suck at that.
All the way in the outer room? Yeah. Compulsive or destructive thinking. Yes. So letting go of a certain kind of thinking. This is not useful kind of thinking. I think I didn't renounce this, let go of that, because it's destructive, it's harmful. So, I think we just kind of began to scratch the surface of the one of the things, classic things to renounce is a certain kind of attachment to self-image, to self-identity. And the classic kind of reference point in Buddhism for renunciation are the monastics, the monks and the nuns. And there, it's very clear that they're renouncing the normal social identities that most people have. And one of the forms it takes, you know, the explicit way, is that they'll shave their heads. And hair is one place where a lot of self-image, self-identity plays itself out, and self-concern. And so when they shave their head, they're symbolizing that they're cutting off that kind of preoccupation and concern with themselves. And a certain kind of freedom or ease can come from that lack of concern. Not that everyone is caught up in self-identity, but tends to be kind of epidemic and contagious enough that some people find it very helpful to kind of do something very radical, to kind of ritually or symbolically or to shut the kind of renounce that or let go of it. So those are all the impulses. Now, in letting go of those impulses, what is gained? We don't have to do as long, but I'd like to hear some of your ideas. What is gained by letting go of some of those impulses?
Freedom.
Spaciousness.
Discomfort.
Joy.
Joy
is gained.
More time.
More time.
More opportunity to be at ease.
More opportunity to be at ease.
Your life back.
Your life back.
Creativity.
Awareness.
Connection.
Freedom from angst.
Peace.
The moment. What good is that? It's so fleeting. It's just like, why would... It's gone before you even notice it. So, well, you know, what good is that? What else? Is that enough? Good enough? You can get lazy. I don't think so. I think that laziness is an activity of the mind. And if you let go well, you'd let go of that activity as well.
If I had nothing to do.
Then you'd respond. Then you'd respond to what's happening around you. I think the natural state of the mind is a state, an aspect of the natural state of the mind is it's responsive. So if someone's walking down the street next to you and slips and falls, if you're open and present, you probably stretch your hand down to help the person up. If your neighbor is sick, you probably go and bring them some soup. You know, so you start responding. And the world needs a lot of people to help respond. So there's no end to it. So, I once heard a Zen saying about kind of defined Zen meditation or Zen practice, and very simply, that there's two aspects of Zen practice: sitting in Zen meditation, and then sweeping the temple courtyard. But the temple courtyard here is symbolic for the whole world. So it's sitting in meditation, coming to that place of peace, that ease, that freedom, and then responding to the leaves in the courtyard by sweeping them, or whatever else is going on around you. So being able to respond. But to be able to respond without losing our happiness or ease or our freedom. So that's why we make a big deal, many people do, the difference between reacting and responding. And a life of freedom is one that's capable of responding instead of reacting. And reacting is habitual reactions, you know what I mean? We react before we even know it. There's no choice in the matter. So there's a lot to be gained by renouncing, by letting go. And in the Buddhist tradition, it's understood that renouncing, that the mental movement to renounce, in order to be healthy, has to is always supposed to be a wholesome state of mind. In other words, it's meant to be a healthy state of mind, so it cannot have any aspect of aversion or ill will or resistance or kind of or greed as part of it. If you're pushing something away because you hate it, I hate that, I'm going to push that away, then it's not really nekkhama, renouncing. Or if you're really greedy for freedom or for peace, then it's not really renouncing. There has to be some quality of health, of ease, of in the act of renouncing itself. And so one of the things, so if you pay attention to ease and what takes you away from it, you'll notice that if you're letting go of something and you're not doing it in a healthy way, part of it is you're not very easy. You'll lose some of your ease in it. Resistance, pushing something away, judging it. If it's a healthy form of renunciation or letting go, then the act itself is a joyful act. And this is one of the things that I learned in recent years about letting go, is that, you know, my years of Buddhist practice, I've done a lot of letting go, and mostly it was, you know, some of it was not always easy, but, you know, something I learned to do relatively well until I had my first child. And then I thought, oh, this is easy, because I just let go of my sleep, let go of, you know, all kinds of things. I just let go, you know, and I had all these things I wanted to do. I was used to doing. I had children and was somewhat, you know, getting on in my adulthood. So I was used to having all this freedom to do things. And I found I couldn't do all these things that I was used to doing. And so, I let go of them. And what I found was that I ended up being resentful, or kind of grumpy. And that wasn't very healthy. And I realized that I hadn't really let go. If I was not happy, if I didn't experience joy in the act of letting go, I learned, watch out, Gail, you're in trouble. Because it'll come back and bite me by being resentful or grumpy or something. And I had to learn to look for, what do I have to let go of so that I can experience the joy of letting go? So that was, you know, the key of it. Where do I find it? So I might have to let go of my sleep or let go of the particular activity I'm doing, but that's not really the issue. The issue would maybe was something deeper, some deeper kind of attachment that was going on. So for example, getting enough sleep, you know, and renouncing my sleep, I could give up my sleep, you know, for the moment, but back in the back of my mind, you know, Saturday night, not being able to sleep, back in my mind was some attachment to being able to give a lucid Dharma talk Sunday morning, because then all of you would like me. And that was still kind of operating back there, you know, like, oh, you know, I have to give, you know, how can I give a good talk if I'm all tired? And so I was a little bit contracted around that, and that was, I had to kind of maybe let go of that too. I just made that story up, I don't know. But you know, there's just, you know, something deeper that needs to be let go of. So what do we have to let go of so that we experience the joy? The joy and delight of letting go, of renunciation. What is gained from it? And if you don't experience joy and delight, maybe you shouldn't let go too quickly. And part of what we do in mindfulness meditation is we try to understand what's going on. So if we don't discover the joy of letting go, maybe don't let go, but rather study the situation more carefully. Understand better what's going on. Hang out with it for a few days or a few weeks or however long. Really get to know something really well. And the theory in Buddhism is that if you know something really, really well, it's going to be easy to find your freedom. So don't be in a hurry to let go of things until you understood what you're letting go of. And then have joy be a guideline for you for that. And last thing I want to say about letting go is that what we let go of, what we can renounce, depends a lot on what our priorities are and what our visions are for what's possible. And if we have a real vision that it's possible to have or attain, reach some great goal, then we're often willing to renounce a lot of things so we can attain that great goal. Olympic athletes will renounce a lot temporarily in the years of training, things that are often very healthy and good for this great goal they're pursuing. If a person has a very clear vision of what's possible to reach or accomplish or do with a spiritual life, then it begins making some sense to kind of rearrange a person's priorities. And perhaps even simplify or let go of things which are actually maybe quite good and quite healthy. But a human being cannot do all the healthy things that's possible, all the great things that are possible. And to be able to choose and simplify one's life, to be able to pursue one or two great goals, is a quite beautiful thing to do in one's life. And the stronger a person's sense of purpose or sense of vision of what's possible, the more things a person can often, in a healthy way, renounce and let go of, so they can really follow through that and follow their heart's deepest wish. Zen Master Suzuki Roshi said, renunciation is allowing things to pass away when they pass away. Something like that. I had a little bit wrong the quote. Some recognition of how things pass. Things are always changing and passing away, and then allowing them to go. And as we get older and older and older. There are a number of things that seem to pass away or not be there in the same way they were when we were younger. And it's possible to hold on to that and feel bitter and angry and disappointed and embarrassed and all those things. But it's also possible to practice Buddhist renunciation with all the things that are passing away, all the capacities that we're losing, and to realize that we can just let go and find joy in letting go. There's so little we need to be happy. And there's something, there's a joy. It's possible to have joy in letting go of what we're losing anyway. Or it's possible to be bitter. I would encourage you to explore how to find the joy of what's inevitable. Find the joy of letting go. Anyway, thank you.